Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Over on Patreon.com, we have got a lot of new exclusive Bowery Boys audio for our super fans, including, of course, our regular Patreon-only show called Side Streets.
And at the $5.5 level and above, I've got a whole episode of bonus scenes from my recent Stories of Flushing show with many more interesting bits of history. Then at the $10 Gilded Age level, you'll get audio from my interview with author Eric J. Dolan, recorded at the New York Historical Society. We're talking privateers, pirates, and the American Revolution.
And that's not all. At that same level, you also get exclusive merchandise, new shows a couple of days before everybody else, and you get all of our podcasts ad-free.
You won't even hear this message. That's all on patreon.com/Bowery Boys.
Your support helps us keep the show running. Thank you so much.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. If you're a Tolkien fan, you know, Lord of the Rings, Hobbit, or you're a C.S. Lewis fan, you probably have heard of the Inklings. If you haven't heard of the Inklings, you're in for a treat. This was a literary group that both Tolkien and Lewis belonged to for over three decades at Oxford, where they got together one night a week to discuss and critique each other's work, but as well as talk about philosophy, religion, myths, et cetera, while smoking pipes and drinking adult beverages. It was like a little men's group. It was only men, all men. Anyways, my guests today on the podcast have written a biography of this group. It's called The Fellowship, The Literary Lives of the Inklings. Their names are Philip and Carol Zaleski. They're a married couple. And today on the show, we're going to discuss the members of the Inklings, Tolkien, Lewis, also some of the more lesser known individuals, but also who had a profound impact on American literature in other ways, Owen Barfield and Charles Williams. And we'll also discuss the lasting impact of the Inklings on a religion in the West, as well as literature in the West. Great discussion. So without further ado, Philip and Carol Zaleski. Philip and Carol Zaleski, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brett.
So you two are a husband-wife team, wrote a book about the Inklings. Now, I know a lot of our listeners know who the Inklings are, have heard of them, and are big fans of two of the members. But for those who aren't familiar, can you tell us what were the Inklings and who belonged to this little group?
You want to dive in, Carol? Or
okay. Yeah. We're in different rooms, so we can't signal to each other. But I'd be happy to start out on that. So the Inklings, was a literary club, a fellowship is how we like to think of it. Which is perhaps runs a little deeper than the affiliations you might have in a club. And it was founded not by Tolkien and Lewis themselves, but by an undergraduate named Edward Tangi Lean, brother of the filmmaker David Lean at Oxford. But Tolkien and Lewis and a few other like-minded friends had been gathering since the late 1920s for literary conversation. They took over from the group called the Inklings that was founded by Edward Tangi Lean late in 1933, and they used to meet in C.S. Lewis's rooms in Magdalen College on Thursday evenings to read their works in progress to each other, and then socially they would meet in various pubs on Tuesday mornings, most likely, and that went on until Lewis died on the same day as JFK in 1963. So it was about 30 years of gatherings with a variety of people joining.
Right. So it was a literary group. And yeah, C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, everyone knows who, a lot of people know who they are. Mm-hmm. Seen Lord of the Rings, you guys know who Tolkien is. But you started off the book talking about sort of the atmosphere at Oxford. I thought this was really interesting. I didn't know much about this, but there was this real culture of club creation. Like there was, it seemed like there was a club for almost anything and everything at Oxford at the time. And the members of the Inklings belonged to other clubs, not just the Inklings. So right. Can you tell us a little bit about this culture of creating clubs and what kind of clubs people could find at Oxford during the early part of the 20th century?
Yeah, well, as you say, the clubs were innumerable, and both Tolkien and Lewis were avid members of these of many clubs. I think I'd start by pointing out that this goes back to Tolkien's teenage years when he formed a club called the Tea Club and Barovian Society, devoted to he and his friends, so three or four close friends, had decided to join this, form this club to bring goodness and honesty and virtue and purity to Western civilization. So Tolkien, at a very early age, was club-oriented. Lewis dove in when he went to Oxford. Clubs that they belonged to included, Lewis belonged to an English faculty club called The Cave. Tolkien belonged to, I wonder if I can remember the name, something called the Checkers Club, I think.
Right.
The essay club.
He founded that one, yeah.
Yeah. He joined the Debating Society, a club called the Dialectical Society. So there were all sorts of clubs. Eventually, he and Tolkien, when they first became friends, formed a club called the Cold Biters, which literally means men biting coal. And it's a reference to ancient Icelandic bards, and this was a society devoted to Norse mythology and Norse literature. And then it all blossomed in the Inklings itself. And while they were writing the great works, they also belonged to other clubs.
I think just to underscore what Phil was saying about the ubiquity of clubs at Oxford, there's also a long tradition of that just in English culture. And we talked about that in the book, that there were forerunners to these clubs. There's a club that called the Friday Street Club that Ben Jonson and John Donne belonged to. Keats even dedicated a poem to it. And there was the Scriblerus Club that had Jonathan Swift and Alexander Pope. And we really were drawn to the club, which was founded by Samuel Johnson and the painter Sir Joshua Reynolds, and had an amazing group of men. Edmund Burke was in it, Adam Smith, Asiatic Jones. And it was similar in many ways to the Inklings. That is, there's no platform for the club. It's just a place to go and hang out with like-minded people.
So, I mean, it sounds like the Inklings was a legacy Enlightenment, because the way you described it, it sounded very much like Benjamin Franklin starting the Mutual Improvement Societies here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in fact, C.S. Lewis is often compared to Samuel Johnson, who is the great Enlightenment figure in English history.
Okay, and is this does this club culture still exist at Oxford?
You know, I looked at the Oxford University website. There's a long, long list of clubs and societies and debating groups which have official sanction, but in that respect, they're not private clubs. I think that the era of the private men's club has faded. I think maybe because it may seem to some people elitist or exclusive or that a kind of multicultural and co-ed environment seems to make it look like a thing of the past. Right. I'm not sure that, I mean, I don't think it's entirely a thing of the past, but I think that makes inroads into club culture.
Right. And that was interesting too about the Inklings. They had a very strict no women rule.
I think that's almost unstated. It's just an assumption that these would be sex segregated clubs. There was, you know, a story used to circulate about Dorothy L. Sayers trying to get into the club and banging on the door and not being let in, but that's apocryphal.
So I know most people who are listening are probably familiar with C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, but there's two other members of the Inklings that you highlight and go into great detail about their biography? Owen Barfield and Charles Williams. And honestly, before I read, but can you tell us a little bit about what they did, their influence on, I guess, English literature or academics at Oxford?
Well, sure. I'd say Charles Williams is by far the better known of the two, because he was a novelist who published quite a number of what people refer to as supernatural shockers. These are thrillers or mystery novels, or that always involve supernatural events. They were quite popular at the time, and they're still popular. There are many avid Williams fans around these days. Williams was in a way, a self-taught man. He worked at Oxford University Press most of his adult life, became a well-known editor there, and befriended Lewis and then the other Inklings. In addition to his spiritual shockers, he wrote some marvelous books on Dante and on Anglican history and on poetry. He considered himself a poet first and foremost. Barfield is a more obscure figure. He was a specialist in the history of language, in the history of words, and how words change over the centuries. And he had this really brilliant idea, which amounts to the reverse engineering of words, where you track the history of words back in time until you get to their primordial meaning. And through this, he thought he could trace the history of human consciousness as well. So as you can imagine, his books are a little more abstruse, obscure, and even occult than Williams are. But he also has a somewhat of a following, some very important people. Saul Bellow, the Nobel Prize winner, most notably, have been students of his or disciples of his. So these are the two most prominent Inklings apart from Lewis and Tolkien, and that's why we chose to focus on them as well. Yeah,
and I guess Barfield, I thought it was interesting. Like, he seemed like his entire life, he was sort of, envious maybe, but a little envious of the success. It wasn't until later on in life that he actually had some renown and some success. He experienced that.
Yeah, it makes for a beautiful story in a way, because it's a great tale of someone who is in the shadows for most of his life. A Barfield didn't have great skills as a fiction writer, couldn't make a living as a writer. You can hardly make a living as a writer of the historian of language. So he went into the law. And while Tolkien and Lewis and many of the other Inklings were basking in public acclaim, poor Barfield was toiling away in his London law office, you know, dealing with real estate matters and torts and so on. But eventually, in the 1960s, people started reading his books, mostly at first because he was known as C.S. Lewis's best friend. And he came to America, Barfield did, and started giving lecture tours around America and teaching at American universities. And these were a smash success, both the teaching and the lecture tours. And people then started reading Barfield's own books, and they discovered that in addition to being Lewis's great friend, Barfield himself had very intriguing ideas to offer. And ideas that fit in rather well with the tenor of the 1960s and 1970s, because he was an esoteric thinker. He was interested in alternative descriptions of history. He rejected Darwinism, for example. He was a follower of a German spiritual teacher named Rudolf Steiner. So Barfield came into his own just when the other Inklings were dying out. And in fact, he lived to be 99 years old So he had a chance to savor his late triumph.
Yeah, it was great to see. Like, it kind of worked out for him in the end.
Yeah.
I'm curious. So you mentioned that there were other members of the group. Like, these are the four most prominent, Lewis, Tolkien, Barfield, and Williams. But it seemed like also the membership of the Inkley was very fluid.
There was the critic and biographer, Lord David Cecil, an immensely attractive figure, an important man of letters, who also had ties to the Bloomsbury Group, which had a very different literary and cultural mindset. But he was that sort of a generous mind that he could live in both worlds. There was an important Chaucer scholar and theater and film director, Neville Coghill, who actually gave Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor their start in Oxford theatrics. And there was a Dominican named Gervase Matthew, scholar, and an English don named Hugo Dyson, very rambunctious fellow. There was also Lewis's brother, Warney, who presided at Inkling's meetings, poured the drinks. Actually, he himself struggled with alcoholism, but he was a very kind man, and he also wrote. He wrote histories of 17th century France. And then a young member was John Wayne, who later became known as one of the group called the Angry Young Men.
Yeah, and didn't also Tolkien's son join as well?
And Tolkien's son, right.
Yeah, who's still alive and is the last living Inkling.
I'm curious. So they had all these members that would come and join, but it seemed like these four were like the core. I'm curious, like, what drew these men together? Because it seems like they come from very different backgrounds, right? You have Tolkien the Catholic with Lewis the atheist turned Anglican. You have Barfield, who was really into esotericism, and you had Williams, who was a poet. I mean, what was it that drew these men? What was the common bond between all of them?
Well, there are several common bonds. First of all, perhaps first and most importantly, they were all writers, and not only writers, but very active and productive writers. The Inklings group really was a writing club. They write each other's unpublished manuscripts, works in progress, and then they severely criticized each other's works. And this criticism improved the works of all the members. So that's something they had in common. In addition, they were all Christians. Lewis said explicitly to Charles Williams that being a Christian was a requirement for joining the group. They were romantics, pretty much to a man. They loved language. They loved stories. They loved fantasy, which set them off from the accepted literary views of the day. And that's something that united them. They were united then in adversity as well as in comradeship.
I'm curious. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Karen. Also, I would add anti-modernism to that, or not in a reactionary anti-modernism, but a desire to see the world re-enchanted through its connection to traditions and values of the past.
Yeah, that was really interesting, particularly when you talk about C.S. Lewis and his literature. Because he wrote sci-fi. A lot of people don't know that, or they forget that.
It really was science fantasy more than science fiction. It was just, it was a way for him to present mythological and spiritual ideas on a broader canvas. He set them on other planets, but I don't think they would be considered anything like hardcore science fiction.
Right. But but is that theme of like, they were sort of anti-modern, but they wanted to recapture, I guess, some of the essence of it?
Yeah, that's how we look at it. It's an effort at what we call recovery rather than reaction. So recovery really brings into the present what is worth saving from the past and what is still a living tradition. So it's not it's not antiquarianism and it's not mere nostalgia, but it's a sense that there's a real live tradition that perhaps we're in a state of amnesia. We've forgotten that it's there, but it's still viable for us. And that's one thing that Owen Barfield helped with, actually. He convinced Lewis that the ideas of the past can be evaluated on their own merits, and that it's only chronological snobbery that makes us think that ideas that were life-giving in the past are no longer available to us.
It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now, and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy-to-follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. Have you always struggled with finding time to manage your finances? At the end of a busy week, the last thing you want to do is spend time budgeting all of your expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions you no longer use. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. My favorite feature on Rocket Money is finding those unwanted subscriptions. If you're like me, you have a bunch of those things you signed up for but forgot about, streaming services, newsletters, maybe some fitness plans. You just connect your account to the app, Rocket Money finds the recurring subscription fees, and then you can easily cancel them from the app. It's a really cool, cool service. They also have a service that can help you lower your bill. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with the customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. That's a lot of money. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness, rocketmoney.com/manliness. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, MANLINESS. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. There have been a lot of amazing people as guests on this podcast, but what if you want to go deeper? If you're looking somewhere to learn from the most remarkable people, that's Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 200 classes to pick from, with new classes added every month, and they have over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. For example, Chris Voss has a class on negotiation, Jocko Willink has a class on leadership, and Malcolm Gladwell has a class on writing. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. One class that I've really enjoyed is the one with Chris Voss on negotiation. My favorite lesson in that class was the lesson on tactical empathy, something we talked about in the podcast that we did with him a long time ago, but he goes in deeper with this. And besides just the lectures, you get exercises so you can actually put this stuff into practice. Right now, listeners will get an additional 15% off annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM.
Great. Phil, you alluded a little bit to the dynamic. It was a writing club. They'd come to each other. Someone would read a work. There was criticism. I mean, do we know what a typical meeting was like, or like the dynamic in a meeting? Do we have records of that?
Yeah, we have diary entries by mostly by Lewis's brother, Warney Lewis, who near the end of his life, lamented several times that he hadn't kept careful notes. I think he said if he realized that what he had had, what he'd been a part of, he would have recorded every meeting in detail. Instead, we just have brief accounts of meetings, but we have many of those. And we know that meetings would start. Well, these were evening meetings for the most part, at least the ones in Lewis's digs at Magdalen College, which were the more important meetings. Those are the ones in which literary work actually went on. The Tuesday morning meetings were more just general socializing. So they would all gather in the evenings, and Warney would take coats and would settle members down with a drink. And then C.S. Lewis would ask if anyone had something to read. And generally someone did, and it would be read. And then the comments would start. They also discussed ideas, all manner of ideas, whether dogs go to heaven, the nature of hell. You know, if I had Warney's diaries in front of me, I could tell you about 30 or 40 amusing things they discussed. There was a lot of friendship, a lot of rivalry, a lot of caustic comments, especially by Hugo Dyson, who could be very funny, but also could be very nasty in his reflections on other people's works and ideas. But there was a lot of laughter. I think the group lasted so long because people really enjoyed the meetings. They enjoyed laughing with each other, telling stories, drinking together, just having a good time together.
And so, I mean, when they did offer criticism, like, did they really go after the person? Was it like gloves off? I mean, I think nowadays when people have like reading, like, you know, writers groups, like everyone wants to be really polite, but I imagine that's not what happened here.
No, they weren't really polite. Sometimes they could be, well, Hugo Dyson could be quite vulgar, but I'll refrain from repeating what he said about Tolkien's elves. Tolkien, for his part, could be quite critical of Lewis because he felt that Lewis was trying to write the kind of mythopoeic imaginative literature that Tolkien himself was dedicated to, but that Lewis was kind of slipshod about it and didn't really work at building out a completely internally coherent mythos when he was creating imaginary worlds. And Tolkien had very high standards about that. No one ever before or ever since Tolkien has accomplished what he did in terms of internally consistent, believable, invented mythologies. So he would criticize Lewis for that. But another thing they did for each other, though, was encouragement. I mean, when in terms of outsiders, they would circle the wagon, so they could be quite critical of one another. But, for instance, when Lewis tried to get his first science fiction fantasy novel published out of The Silent Planet, the readers' reports were pretty bad, and the publisher was pretty negative about it until Tolkien intervened on Lewis's behalf and praised it to the hilt, even though privately with Lewis, he had had some serious criticisms of it. But again, when they're against the world, against the modernist literary establishment, or simply trying to get their work out there and get it appreciated, they would review each other's works and they would write to publishers and intercede for one another.
Yeah, this encouragement, in fact, that they offered each other was especially important for Tolkien, who's always very hesitant about exposing his great mythology to the public, and who always had doubts about Lord of the Rings, which took him an eternity to write. And if without Lewis's constant encouragement and goading, we wouldn't have the Lord of the Rings today. And thanks to Lewis, we do.
Yeah, I was surprised how long it took him to write that. I mean, it just seemed like decades he was working on it.
Yeah.
Well, the problem was that it started out to be, it was meant to be a sequel to The Hobbit. The Hobbit had been a book that he had written without great agony because it started with just telling stories to his kids. That came naturally. But he had been working since he was a young man in the trenches in the First World War. He'd been working on a private mythology and invented languages to go with it. And that's what he really wanted to publish. But instead, the publishers were interested in you know, the new Hobbit novel, the Hobbit sequel. So he's trying to write the Hobbit sequel, but the mythology keeps working its way into that. And it was very hard for him to integrate these two dramatically different kinds of creative work. In The Lord of the Rings, you can see some of the strains, the sort of places where it didn't knit together perfectly.
You mentioned that, you know, he was working on this during World War One. That's another thing that all these men had in common, or for most of them, they all served during World War One. Did that common bond like serve as some like a way to foster some camaraderie between all of them?
Well, it was tremendously important. In fact, we in our book, The Fellowship, we look at all these writers, most especially Lewis and Tolkien, as war writers. Sure, they were fantasists, but they were also war writers. All of them wrote about war in their fiction. And it's ever-present in Lord of the Rings. You can't understand Lord of the Rings without knowing about Tolkien's experience in the war. And sure, they shared with the other Inklings. Some of the younger ones only experienced World War II, I suppose. That was certainly true of Christopher Tolkien. But they all had war experience, or most of them had war experience. Even the ones who didn't get to actively fight, like Williams and Barfield, played a part in the war somehow.
Yeah, and I think the question you raised earlier about the maleness of this club, I think of interest to your readers and listeners. I think that has a lot to do with it. Tolkien wrote that by 1918, all but one of his close friends had died. These men experienced both the male camaraderie and bonding of the war and the severe loss of having friends fall to the left and to the right and to the front and to the back of them during the war. So when they returned from the war, they had every reason to prize male fellowship. It was a precious and a precarious and a very, you know, damaged gift.
Yeah, I think I remember there's a line where Lewis talks about, I guess that's sort of him relishing male camaraderie, where he says one of the best sounds in the world is like the sound of male laughter.
Yeah, his favorite sound, adult male laughter.
Adult male laughter.
And that is a great sound.
It is, because you don't hear it all that often.
I teach at a women's college, and I try to present that in a way that my students will be sympathetic to it, and they generally are, because that is a special thing.
You really don't hear it all that often, because it's very rare where men, older men, adult men who are married, get together mm-hmm. and have a good time.
Yeah, of course, it's a good way to escape from the domestic
right.
situation, too.
So let's talk a little more about Lewis and Tolkien, because I think their relationship is really interesting. Because as I read the book, it seemed that it ebbed and flowed throughout the years, and that there was a bit of strain there between the two. I got the impression that the strain was because both of these men had high expectations on what friendship meant. Can you talk a little bit about how each man viewed friendship and the role it should play in a person, or particularly a man's life?
You want to tackle that, girl?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, Lewis, you know, wrote a book called The Four Loves, in which one of the loves he talks about is friendship. And in that book and in other places, too, he's the one that kind of articulated a theory of friendship, which is that especially male friendship, what characteristic of it is that they're not really focused on each other. They're focused on a common interest, a common ideal. And you can see this in Tolkien's teenage friendship that Phil was talking about, the Tea Club and Barovian Society. They were really dedicated to something beyond themselves. And so dedicated as they were to shared ideals outside of simply their own personalities, they could still have friction that is the result of differences in their personalities. And, you know, when women come into the picture, it's kind of like Yoko Ono breaking up the Beatles, you know, or not, well, causing tensions. They had very different life situations. Tolkien was very uncomfortable when Lewis got together with this divorcee, Joy Davidman didn't approve of that relationship. There were a number of things Lewis did that Tolkien didn't approve of. They had religious differences, too. Tolkien felt that Lewis never totally overcame his anti-Catholicism from his Belfast background.
But still, the friendship was sustained over the decades, ebbing and flowing, as you said, but it was sustained. It's interesting to look at The Lord of the Rings in this, with this in mind, because The Lord of the Rings, as well as being a war tale, is also a tale of friendship, of course. And in fact, a friendship not only among people who had different religious views, but people of different species, elves, yeah. hobbits, dwarves, and human beings. And they had tensions, as we know from the book and from the films, simply by their species differences. But nonetheless, the fellowship remained. And I think that's, in a way, an account of the Inklings as well.
Yeah. I'm curious, like, what do you think their legacy is? I mean, I think we all know, like, their literary legacy for C.S. Lewis or Tolkien. Like, where do we still see, like, that was because of the, it wasn't because of the individual. It was like, we can look at something either in Christianity or in literature, and we can say, it wasn't just Tolkien that had that influence. It wasn't just Lewis. It was like, it was the dynamic of the group that had that influence. Like, if it weren't for the group, that would not have happened. Is there anything that you all can point to?
Well, I think that in certain ways, they had different sectors of influence. So Lewis became the leading Christian writer of the 20th century, certainly the most influential public figure, bringing about countless conversions among intellectuals and all sorts of people as a popular voice. Tolkien, who was not so comfortable with that aspect of Lewis's legacy, more or less created the whole fantasy world that we're familiar with in various genres like gaming and so on. But, you know, Lord of the Rings is certainly the most successful work of fantasy of all time. So the two of them together are real culture makers. And the group as a whole could be seen as culture making. But in different ways, not in one monolithic way. It isn't, you know, it isn't a movement with placards and manifestos, so that their influence is a little more subtle than that, but extremely strong.
So how did the dynamic of the group change? Did it just because of old age, they stopped meeting less and sickness? Did the Inklings, I guess they are disbanded because like only one of them is alive, but did they disband because of death, or did they disband because they decided to stop seeing?
Well, if you compare it to a group like the Beatles, the Inklings really, they lasted much longer and they were much better friends even while they were lasting. Nonetheless, there were, as we've said, irritants within the group, especially Hugo Dyson. Hugo Dyson got so rambunctious and complained so much about Tolkien's elves at the meetings that Tolkien stopped reading Lord of the Rings, and other members stopped reading various aspects of their work because of complaints, too many attacks and so on. So there was all that friction. Then there was the fact that they were getting older and turning in other directions. The Inklings eventually stopped as an active literary group in the 1940s, but kept late 40s, 48 or 49, I believe, and but kept up as a social group until Lewis's death in the 1960s. So they did last an awfully long time.
Yeah, I think Lewis was really the center of the group. So Lewis, towards the end of his life, in the late 40s, finally got the recognition he deserved. He was given a chair, not at Oxford, but at Cambridge. So he was commuting to Cambridge and managed to have the Tuesday morning gatherings with him, but there was no longer the Thursday evening literary workshop sort of gatherings in Lewis's rooms. So that marked a dramatic change.
I'm curious, are you all aware of any literary groups like this today, like little private groups in existence, like that had the same sort of dynamic as the English?
Well, there's an awful lot of writing groups around. You know, every time I go into Barnes & Noble, I see a group in a corner who are trying to break into print, and they share works with each other, but I doubt any of them measure up to the Inklings.
Yeah, they're probably not talking about whether dogs go to heaven.
But they're talking, well, there, you know, there are definite attempts to be Inklings groups and all kinds of really self-conscious attempts to follow in that tradition. There's a writer named Diana Pavlak-Glyer who wrote a book about the collaboration among the Inklings themselves called The Company They Keep, and then most recently has a book out about literary collaboration and how wonderful it is.
Well, I'm curious, okay, speaking of, like, you two are a husband and wife team. You wrote this book together. That's the same, like, my wife and I, we work on the website together. We write content together. I'm curious how that I'm always curious about how other husband-wife teams work together. Tell us a little about your dynamic, and maybe have you all gotten some inspiration from the Inklings on how to critique each other or help each other out with your writing?
Oh, well, with us, it's been roses all the way, so we haven't needed inspiration from
I'm sure.
However, we do have a method we use, which is, well, in terms of the fellowship, Carol wrote to her strengths and I wrote to mine. Without getting specific as to what each of those are, I'll say we divided the book into different sections, and then we would tackle whatever sections were assigned to each of us, and then we would exchange what we had written, and the other person would offer a critique and a rewrite, not in the Dysonian method of savage attack, but I think much more kindly and perhaps perceptively seeing what was needed. And then we would just mesh it all together. So we actually end up, we think, with a work that speaks with a single voice, but the voice of two people joined in song.
Nice analogy there. Well, Carol and Phil, where can we learn more about your work in the book?
I guess you could Google us.
That's the best thing to do, yeah.
Yeah. You know, then you get to things like the Amazon page where we have both our joint and our separate books. I think there's a couple Wikipedia.
Wikipedia, yeah.
Great. Well, Carol, Phil Zielinski, thank you so much for your time. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, pleasure for us, too.
It's been fun. Thank you, Brett.
My guests today were Philip and Carol Zielinski. They're the authors of the book, The Fellowship, The Literary Lies of the Inklings. And that's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy the podcast, I'd appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And as always, I appreciate your support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.